Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On Tuesday, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein introduced a plan that would allow the federal government to step in and rein back health insurance premium hikes deemed to be unreasonable. A month after the big health care bill was signed into law, why do soaring premiums still need to be dealt with? And is federal intervention the right tack to take? This hour on Point, we're looking at rising premiums and the next steps on health care reform. You can join the conversation. Once the health care bill was passed, did you think the battle over premium hikes was over? Is the cost of your plan going up? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first from Chicago this hour is Noam Levy. He's health policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, welcome back to On Point.
Hi there.
Senate Democrats proposed this plan for the federal government to rein in these skyrocketing insurance premiums. Help us understand exactly what is in this proposal.
Well, the health care bill that the president signed last month includes some provisions to help government regulators at both the federal level and the state level to control the rise in insurance premiums. But there is a fear among consumer groups and some lawmakers, like Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, that those tools are inadequate. So what Senator Feinstein is proposing in the Senate, and as a companion bill in the House by Representative Jan Schakowsky from Illinois, is to have the federal government basically set a floor for state regulators, to give state regulators the authority to deny insurance premiums if they're unjustified. That's a big step forward for a lot of states. Right now, health insurance is regulated at the state level. It's something historically it's been the case for decades. But the result is that there's a vast difference in the way that different states go about doing that. Some states are very aggressive in the way they regulate health insurance. And with that, they require insurance companies to file justifications for their rates, and they occasionally will deny them. In other states, there's not even a requirement to file the information, so there's almost no regulation of what insurance companies are charging their customers.
So it's a real patchwork state to state. Let me step back a bit, because I think many people this week, I have heard them saying that regulating insurance rates was one issue that made them want to support this federal health care legislation. So was there a misperception, Noam, about what health care reform would actually accomplish with regard to insurance premiums?
No, I don't think there was a misperception. The health care legislation that passed does, in fact, lay out a vast new regulatory framework for restraining some of the worst abuses by insurance companies and ultimately setting up these exchanges that we've heard so much about, regulated marketplaces where insurance companies will have to compete. But specifically controlling how much insurance companies can charge is an issue that didn't get as much detail in the bill as I think people may have thought, in part because a couple of reasons. President Obama talked a lot about it in the run-up to the to the vote.
Right.
You may recall, your listeners may recall, there were huge premium increases in California, 39%, as high as 39% by Anthem Blue Cross there. So the president kept saying we need to do things to control how much insurance companies are charging. And ultimately in the bill, there are things that will change, I think, the way that healthcare is delivered in a way that may ultimately do that. But the hammer of being able to have regulators say, no, we will not allow this kind of premium hike, didn't actually make it in the bill. And the reason for that is sort of a technical little window into the way Congress works. At the end, the House had to approve a bill that the Senate wrote, and then they had to use, you may recall, this budget reconciliation process. And there wasn't a way under the congressional budget rules to actually insert this additional authority into the bill at the end, although I think the administration wanted it. Certainly a lot of Democrats wanted it.
Here's Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, who introduced this legislation on Tuesday for federal regulation of insurance premiums. She spoke at a Senate Health Committee hearing on premium increases, and she ended her statement with a blistering critique of health insurance companies.
Medical insurance should be nonprofit, but it is for profit. And there is a very large part of the premium dollar that goes for administrative expenses rather than medical care. The health care reform bill reduces that to 15%, and I think that's good news. But to have an industry that really doesn't have the moral compass to understand what people are going through when they're making enormous profits at the same time, I find extraordinarily difficult to endure.
Noam Levy, will you speak about these enormous profits about which Senator Feinstein refers? Are insurance companies being greedy with their sky-high premiums? You mentioned the 39% increase in California in just one case. Or, from their perspective, are they now being mandated to take on so many more patients, who many of whom are very sick or need expensive care, that they really have no other choice?
Well, health insurance in this country is a vast and varied landscape. There are some of the largest health insurance companies in the country are for-profit companies. They're publicly traded. These are the WellPoints, United Health, Humana, Cigna, Aetna. We've heard of them. There are a lot of them that are nonprofit still out there. Some of them are quite large. Some of them are quite small, and some of them operate just in one state. Now, The for-profit sector of the health insurance industry, which has been growing very rapidly, I mean, health insurance traditionally was not a for-profit enterprise, has generated some large profits for the companies. Though I should note that there are other sectors of the healthcare industry that are considerably more profitable, such mm-hmm. as drug companies and device makers. Mm-hmm. But because the companies are under the for-profit companies are under enormous pressure to satisfy Wall Street investors, they're always looking for ways to minimize their risk and to minimize how much they pay out in medical claims. One of the things that investors look at very closely when they track these major for-profit health companies is something called the medical loss ratio. That's the amount, the percentage of money, the percentage of the company's revenue that they are turning around and paying for medical claims.
Right.
If that's high, investors get worried because investors want to see that the company has a big cushion, that they have a lot of money that they're not having to send to doctors and hospitals that can be reserved for profit. And so that dynamic is one that I think Senator Feinstein was alluding to and that has disturbed many people going forward and looking to try to rein in the abuses of the industry.
So many issues to get to here. Noam Levy, hold on just a moment. Let me bring in from Washington, D.C. now, Carmen Balver. She's Washington Director of Consumer Watchdog, a nonprofit organization that advocates for consumer and taxpayer interests. Carmen Balver, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And with us from Bethesda, Maryland, is Gail Wilensky. She's an economist and senior fellow at Project HOPE, an international health education foundation. She ran the Medicare and Medicaid programs under President George H.W. Bush. She was also an advisor to presidential candidate John McCain and helped write the McCain health care plan. Gail Wilensky, welcome back to you. It's always great to hear from you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Carmen Balver, I'll start with you. Do you support Senator Feinstein's proposal?
We do support Senator Feinstein's proposal and think it's a long overdue federal look at the high profits and high prices that health insurers are charging consumers. So we applaud Senator Feinstein for including this look at what consumers will pay for the product that Congress has now decided to require every American to buy, and that's their health insurance.
Gail Wilensky, is this Senate proposal to regulate skyrocketing insurance premiums the right thing to do right now?
It is especially the wrong thing to do right now. Healthcare reform has just passed. It puts an enormous amount of responsibility onto the federal government, HHS, my old agency, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in particular, and also on the states. Second of all, it includes, as several people have mentioned, limits as to how much can be spent on non-medical portions in health insurance. And so the notion of trying to control the medical loss ratio has been taken on directly. But third, and this is perhaps the most interesting thing to have this conversation coming out of Massachusetts, where states that wish to control premiums directly, not just require private approval, already are doing so. That's most states. And those that wish to control the actual premium increase directly, as Massachusetts does, can do so as well. The issue that has arisen in Massachusetts, I would just like to make sure people understand, is all among the not-for-profit insurance industry. This is much more complex than just, oh, insurance companies looking for profits. What we've now to focus on is implementing all the change that's in place, and particularly trying to get active on reducing the costs of health care, which, again, involves enormous amount of activity that HHS and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services will have to focus on. That's really what needs to happen.
We'll talk more in detail about the Massachusetts model as it relates to this. But in our 30 seconds here before our break, Carmen Balber, what do you make of the timing of these Senate proposals? Is this a dawning proposal on the heels of new federal health care reform that has just passed?
This is a proposal that should have been included in the health reform bill to begin with. We're talking about legislation that newly requires every single American to purchase a private health insurance product. If the government's going to require every American to purchase that product, somebody has to be looking at what the private insurance industry is going to be charging consumers. Now, we were talking about the fact that the bill does limit what health insurers can spend on medical care, but that number can be manipulated by insurance companies unless we're also looking at their overall insurance premium.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about rising health insurance premiums and a new plan to rein them back. We're joined this hour by Noam Levy, health policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Also, Carmen Balber, Washington, D.C. director for Consumer Watchdog, and by economist Gail Wilensky. She ran the Medicare and Medicaid programs under President George H.W. Bush and helped write the McCain health care plan. Back in February, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius spoke after Anthem Blue Cross announced that it would raise rates for California customers up to 39%. The secretary argued that large rate hikes of this kind demonstrated the need for comprehensive health reform.
I think this kind of rate increase gives a highlight to why the president said a year ago, we need to address health reform, comprehensive health reform, as part of addressing the economy. We won't fix the economy without fixing our health care system.
Noam Levy, I'll start with you. Gail Wilensky mentioned the Massachusetts model of health care. We'll get to that more broadly speaking. I'm curious how states are responding to the Feinstein proposal this week.
Well, there are the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is the group that represents state insurance regulators nationally, is talking with the federal, with the Obama administration and with folks on Capitol Hill about this. There is a lot of state regulators are wary of having the federal government come in and take over this this responsibility for a number of different reasons. And not just turf. Because healthcare in this country is so fragmented, and because the individual insurance and medical markets around the country are so different, a lot of insurance regulators feel that really it is the insurance officials at the state level who are best positioned to evaluate whether or not insurance companies are charging fair premiums. And what's particularly important is not just what we've talked about in terms of whether premiums are too high, but also whether premiums are too low. I mean, initially the reason to have state insurance regulators was to assure that insurance companies were charging enough that they could stay in business, because one of the fears is that if either state or federal regulators get too aggressive about controlling how much insurance companies can charge, they could go out of business. And if they go out of business, then their customers are even in even worse shape. But that being said, there is an ongoing conversation, and there are some who feel that establishing some minimum standard for review of rates nationally may not be such a bad thing.
Carmen Balber, do you think states are in the best position to regulate insurance premiums? Because right now, there are many states where nothing is being done.
We're absolutely supportive of the states as the first line of defense for consumers. In California, where WellPoint's 39% rate increase for individual policyholders sparked this national debate anew back in February with that clip from Secretary Sebelius, California does not have the authority to oversee health insurance rate increases. However, they do have the authority in California to oversee auto, homeowners, and other property casualty insurance regulation. That regulatory law in California has saved auto insurance consumers $62 billion since it was enacted in 1988. We've seen the proof of how successful state-based insurance regulation can be, and we think that has to be the first line of defense. However, Senator Feinstein had it right when she said if the states fail to act, someone has to be there to protect insurance consumers. That's where the federal government has to act as a backstop for consumers who aren't being protected at the state level.
Gail Wilensky, let's get back to Massachusetts. So the Massachusetts healthcare model, you brought that up before the break. It's a model that mandates coverage, seems to be the closest model to the federal reform that just passed. What lesson do you take from Massachusetts? What does Massachusetts teach us?
First, that expanding coverage can be done. It's the relatively easy part of healthcare reform. Massachusetts has done a good job getting health insurance coverage to almost all of its citizens. Second of all, it doesn't in and of itself take on the harder problem, improving quality and outcomes or slowing spending. Massachusetts is just beginning to grapple with that. And third, that this is not just an issue of for-profit insurance companies. The struggle that is going on in Massachusetts right now is being raised by not-for-profit insurance companies that are trying to deal with increasing spending and having this tug go on with the state about how to get a handle on costs. It is going to be a challenge for the country as well. The states have the authority now if they want to directly control premiums. It is much more complicated than directly controlling premiums.
Directly controlling costs is certainly an issue in Massachusetts here. Another issue is that we do have a lot of physicians. We have a lot of doctors in our system, and yet we're quickly learning that we still don't have enough to cover everyone. So I'm curious, if we're struggling in Massachusetts, what will they possibly do in states where they don't have nearly as many doctors to cover patients who need it?
They're going to have to find community health centers and rural health centers, a different mix of nurse practitioners and primary care. There are states that are going to need enormous amount of help getting going, particularly many of those in the South, which have had low Medicaid programs, relatively small numbers of people on Medicaid. They're now going to be required by early 2014 to include everyone under 133% of the federal poverty line. For some of our poorer states, that is an enormous share of the population, and they're going to have everyone be able to buy negotiated insurance up to four times the poverty line. Again, for our poorer states, that's practically everybody in the state. We're going to have to see a lot of support go to states that don't have the infrastructure in place that a Massachusetts or a Maryland does already.
Is that a concern, Carmen?
Well, absolutely. I think when we're talking about Massachusetts as a model, and it is indubitably the model that we have to look to as the only place in the nation that has implemented a health insurance mandate, we have to consider the fact that Massachusetts is experiencing the same premium increases that consumers are around the nation. And what we saw over the last several months in Massachusetts was the state insurance commissioner turning around and refusing to approve 230 proposed small business health insurance rate increases with a prior approval rate regulatory authority that is very similar to what we're talking about for other states and that Senator Feinstein has proposed at the federal level. Massachusetts found that health insurers could not justify the health insurance rate increases that they were trying to charge to small businesses. So the insurance commissioner rejected those increases, said, justify these premiums or we won't let you charge small businesses more.
I've got a mountain of callers here waiting to get in. Let's go to Josh in Enterprise, Alabama. Josh, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Jane. I'd just like to point out that I support the fact that the federal government needs to have some sort of regulation on health care premiums, particularly here in Alabama. Our attorney general is actively advertising that he is opposing the health bill in its entirety. And I'm a small business owner. I have diabetes, which is a pre-existing condition. I had finally gotten an insurance company that would accept me because of the health bill. When he started that advertisement, they promptly withdrew their acceptance. And so I really feel that the federal government needs to be able to step in and control areas where this might be an issue or where insurance companies just aren't regulated enough.
Josh, thank you so much. There's Josh in Alabama talking about some states just don't want any reform. In fact, there are multi-state lawsuits which challenge the constitutionality of this federal health care reform and requiring Americans to buy health insurance. How does that play into all this, Noam?
Well, it's a big. It's a big issue. I think there's some doubt about whether the legal challenges will last, and sort of potentially more of a political maneuver than anything else. But you know what Gail was talking about earlier about the capacity of states, particularly in the South, to implement some of this reform, whether it be expanding Medicaid, whether it be creating these new insurance marketplaces, or whether it be stepping up regulation of insurers or any other part of the healthcare system, I think is a real question. And I mean, if there was a governor or an attorney general in a place like Alabama who doesn't believe in the healthcare bill, there are any number of ways administratively that a state could potentially stand in the way of implementing parts of this bill. And as we've seen in Massachusetts, it's hard enough to do this when there are elected officials who want to do it. It's gonna be a big test for a lot of states going forward.
Gail Walensky, can you imagine a scenario wherein, under the new federal health care reform law and now with the U.S. Senate proposal to regulate insurance premiums, can you imagine insurance companies saying, I'm sorry, we just can't do business in that particular state? It's just not financially feasible for us.
We may see how that plays out in Massachusetts first. I don't have any idea about the justification of the rate increases that were being requested. I obviously not privy to that information. But this is not ended yet. You have a group of not-for-profit companies saying we can't make it under the existing rates. We'll see ultimately how that plays out. There was something similar to that happened in Kentucky a number of years ago where most of the companies that were providing insurance in Kentucky pulled out of the state for at least a portion of the time, leaving very little in the way of choice. I assume we will sort those problems out. The man who called in, though, from Alabama will be helped enormously by the legislation that was just passed. Small business owner, he'll be able to buy negotiated insurance plans through the exchange. States that don't comply with the law, the federal government will come in to make sure that this is available. As somebody who's actually tried to run Medicare and Medicaid, and it is quite the challenge, although gratifying, I am very sympathetic to what we've already put in place, huge implementation challenges at the federal level, at the state level, even more so, particularly for states without a lot of infrastructure in place. My plea is do not add more legislation now before we've started. We will see many unintended consequences in legislation this large. We'll have to go in and fix those as they come up. We'll see legislation coming up every year in this area, just as we see legislation affecting Medicare every single year come up in the Congress. Just take a deep breath. Let some of this begin to play out.
Carmen Balber, there's Gail Wilensky saying no more legislation. This is already too complicated. What's your response?
Well, I think we have to. I would like to just quickly go back to this idea that Massachusetts, because it has nonprofit health insurers, can do no evil. There was recently a big firestorm in Massachusetts because the nonprofit Blue Cross Blue Shield CEO got a huge salary increase and is being paid a lot of money. That money is being passed on to insurance policyholders. That's the kind of number, how much money a health insurer pays in political contribution, how much they pay their CEO, whether or not they're inflating, how much they're paying out on medical care, that strong rate regulation would be able to oversee.
Back to the phones, to Lincoln, Rhode Island. Adrian is calling. Hi, welcome to the program. Hello.
Yes, hi, Jean.
Hello.
Listening to NPR's tireless, exalted reporting on Obamacare reminds me of listening many, many years ago to Radio Tirana telling the world how lucky the people of Albania were. They're having the blessings of socialism bestowed on them by their dear leader, Enver Hoxha. You might not be old enough to remember, but I do. Now, should not I expect you and your guests to bring some historical perspective to the healthcare debate? Should not I expect you to know that the cornerstone for today's dysfunctional healthcare system was laid by FDR during the Second World War when he instituted wage and price controls? Price controls by administered by this misguided Harvard economics professor John Kenneth Galbraith. My question, why do you and your guests expect that more of the same, more government interference in the market, is the solution? Why does not NPR speak out for freedom, for the protection of inalienable rights as a solution?
Adrian, thank you very much. Carmen Balber, you hear Adrian saying government intervention is not the answer here.
Well, number one, I think we should all be very clear that the health plan that passed Congress is far from government-run health care. We're talking about a system that will require everyone to purchase private health insurance on the open market. The health reform that passed is setting rules in place to make sure that health insurers under that new system can't completely rip off consumers. So it does things like require them to sell insurance to everyone who comes regardless of their medical condition. Health insurance, in our opinion, health care, in our opinion, is something that's required by everyone and should be overseen by the government. But this is in no way, shape, or form a public health plan.
Here's John in Winooski, Vermont. John, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
As I said to your call screeners, I am definitely a proponent of smaller government, without a doubt. But I do believe that it is time for the government to step in. I see profiteering of the worst kind going on here, akin to the profiteering of the people selling generators during the Vermont ice storm for 10 times their value. I have a perfect example of that kind of profiteering, if you'd like to hear it.
Okay, quickly before our break here.
Look, recently I was in our local hospital. I have severe asthma. I had no asthma medicine at home, so I went to the hospital. I received 2 ampules of albuterol and sat on the bed with no other assistance for an hour and was charged $1,700. Now, you tell me that's fair pricing.
John, thank you very much. Noam Levy, there's John saying that there's a lot of profiteering going on. I suppose you hear that a lot in your reporting.
I do, although, you know, I don't know about the specifics of his experience, but he raises a point which we haven't talked a lot about and which does bear on what's happened in Massachusetts and bears on premiums, and that is, what are the costs of the underlying medical care that is being delivered, whether it be the drugs that consumers are demanding, whether it's the hospitalizations that they want, whether it is the imaging that they want. One of the things that is driving up premiums, irregardless of profiteering that may or may not be happening in the insurance sector, is utilization and prices. Doctors, hospitals, drug companies charge more for their products. People want more access to health care. That helps drive up the cost of medical care, and that gets passed on through premiums. And that's an issue that's even more difficult to deal with than regulating insurance premiums. It's one that the health care bill sort of begins to take a stab at, but one that that probably we're going to be talking a lot more about between now and 2014 and even into the future, I suspect.
The This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about rising health insurance premiums and the next steps on health care reform. We're joined this hour by Noam Levy, health policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times, also by Carmen Balber, Washington, D.C. director for Consumer Watchdog, and Gail Walensky, economist and health policy expert. At the Senate Health Committee hearing on Tuesday of this week, Karen Ignami, president and CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans, which is an advocacy group of about 1,300 health insurers, said that the premium hikes have been caused by underlying costs, not insurance company greed.
The concerning issue that's relevant today is that federal and state data have shown that premium increases are being driven by the growth in the underlying costs of healthcare services and the utilization of these services. And new spending projections by CMS has found that healthcare as a percentage of gross domestic product had the largest one-year increase on record. The only way premiums will be brought under control is for the country to more directly take on these challenges.
The largest one-year increase on record for healthcare costs. Gail Walensky, do you think that the real issue here are the underlying costs of healthcare?
It's probably the single biggest, hardest issue that we're going to have to deal with. We've known for many years that we see unsustainable growth rate increases in healthcare, 2.5 percentage points faster than the economy. It's true in Medicare. It's true for the rest of healthcare. There are a lot of very interesting pilot studies that are included in the legislation to see whether we can't reward physicians and hospitals that keep people healthy, have the incentives encourage better health outcomes instead of just doing more and more complex procedures. It's a big problem for Medicare, which rewards physicians for doing more and more complex and penalizes the physician that listens and helps through better education and counsel their patients. It is going to be very hard to figure out what works for certain parts of the country, what works in other parts of the country. I hope Massachusetts will help us. They're actually a leading example of one of the highest costs of healthcare delivery in the country. They are now being forced to take on this issue because they have solved the first easier problem, but important problem, which is making sure people have coverage.
To this point, let's go to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where Jenny is on the line. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you, Jane?
Hi, fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, my question is, I was disappointed, and I just don't know if I'm educated enough on this. I was hoping that the new health care reform would have a public option. I really felt that this would be what would kind of rein in the private sector by having that competition. And I think what happens is, like your caller from Alabama or anybody with a pre-existing, now they're going to have their hand forced at buying private insurance. And I'm sure for somebody with a pre-existing condition, and maybe I don't know about this either, but I'm sure they're going to be charged much more. Somebody who's had a history of cancer, history of diabetes, asthma, so on and so forth, than, you know, a 26-year-old that's relatively healthy. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what the implications of this are going to be. And I don't really understand either what the big deal was about having a public option, because if you're over 65, there's a public option, Medicare. If you're below the poverty level, Medicaid. So it's the middle class, lower middle class people that are under 65 that are in a bind. And I just don't know, I don't understand what's going to happen to those pre-existing people, and are the insurance companies just going to gain more and more without any.
Jenny, thank you. Thank you very much. It's a really good point. Carmen Balber, Jenny's saying if there had been a public option in this health care bill, we wouldn't be talking about all these costs right now.
Well, we absolutely agree that a public option was the number one way to provide an alternative to the high costs in the private health insurance market, whether for-profit or nonprofit. And I think she also raised a very important point about people who have pre-existing conditions, or if we step away from that health insurer language and simply say people who have some sort of chronic medical condition, whether it's diabetes like your caller, whether it's asthma, and what those people who have higher medical costs legitimately will be paying for their health insurance. We are seeing right now in the health insurance market a tactic by health insurers to what they consider legitimately raise premiums, what they're doing is shifting those higher cost consumers into individual plans and then raising costs for those individuals. That's the kind of gaming of the system, gaming of rate increases that we think is so critical for a regulator, whether it's at the states preferably or the federal if it must be, to be overlooking to make sure that consumers aren't paying more than a fair price for their health insurance.
Noam Levy, will you speak about that gaming of the system if insurance companies know they're going to be regulated, raising their rates now in a free market before the government tells them they can't?
Well, there is a fair amount of concern that there is some of that going on, and that there's, one of the things that's going to happen in 2014 when these new exchanges come into place is there's going to be a lot of restrictions on insurance companies' ability to charge more to people who are sicker, even though there are going to be allegedly some adjustments for the risk pool that various companies have. There is a fear that companies, before that happens, are trying to position themselves to sort of take advantage of the last few years that they have before the really intense regulation kicks in.
Let me go to Kathleen now. She's in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me on your program.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
It is well known that for each doctor in private practice or group practice or hospital practice, the amount of around and upwards of $67,000 a year is what is required to process all of the paperwork, the insurance, the pre-authorizations, all of the coding and the puzzles that have to be worked out for a patient to obtain a service. And I think there's an area where significant cost savings can be obtained.
You sound like a physician, are you, Kathleen? You sound like you know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I do, unfortunately. I teach in a medical school. I teach first-year and second-year students.
Mm-hmm.
None of them can go into primary care because they can't afford it.
They can't afford it, right.
They each have somewhere around $200,000. In debt.
Mm-hmm.
One of them will be $250,000 in
so
debt.
So as a physician, what do you think about federal government stepping in to rein in these skyrocketing insurance premiums? And is it the state's job? What do you think about as a physician that?
Okay. With regard to state versus national, I'm just not well-versed enough in that area. But I have to say, we have to think about it. Insurance companies are businesses. They won't exist unless they can make enough money to exist. That's a problem. And is healthcare a business? I'm not so certain that the business model applies or maps one-to-one onto healthcare. So what we have here is a business that needs to make money to survive, and we have a healthcare, shall we say, system or requirement or need that is really could be thought of as a common good. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's very, very tricky. Could we go back to the $67,000 question? Just for
okay, Kathleen, I will. I'll pose it to Gail Walensky. What do you think, Gail?
I'm glad you have posed that because in 2013, under the insurance reform provisions, there's a requirement that there be a single set of operating rules for eligibility verification and claim status that begin starting with rules as early as 2011 being issued, and that this is going to be a requirement in order to have claims processes and move back and forth. So there will be an attempt to see whether or not we can't begin to have more uniformity in terms of how the processings of claims actually go on. With regard to the second point about the cost of training physicians and whether that influences selection. I've long been a proponent of having targeted loan forgiveness
mm-hmm.
for medical students who want to go into areas of short supply or specialties of short supply like primary care or go to work in shortage areas or in urban poverty areas or in rural areas. Some of those incentives are included in the legislation, could do a lot more to help target the help to physicians who will go to where they're really needed. We're going to have to rely on nurse practitioners. We're going to have to rely on having more community health centers, more team approach. This is, again, way more complicated than just regulating insurance premiums. It is trying to move to a whole different delivery system, a team approach, different incentives, and we have to understand that this is not going to happen in a year or two. If we can see some significant changes over the course of the next decade in terms of the delivery of care, we will have made momentous change in forward progress.
We'll be doing well. Noam Levy, let me turn briefly to another issue, and that is fraud with this new federal health care law passing. I'm reading a Time magazine article here detailing seductive infomercials or mailings from so-called companies that offer to comprehensive coverage on the cheap, knowing that this is on people's minds. How widespread is this from your reporting?
Well, I've seen a few of these myself. I mean, they're pretty pernicious. These are things oftentimes advertised as health plans, which is not what they are. These sort of pseudo kinds of plans that claim to cover certain things and don't. I think it's a caution to people to be very careful before they decide to buy anything, to make sure that that what they're getting is a real plan, and to make sure that they understand that the federal government is not offering any new plans themselves at this point, so there aren't any federally protected new insurance products that are all of a sudden available because of this bill.
Mm-hmm.
There will be going forward, but at this point there aren't, so people just really need to be careful.
Back to the phones now. Wallingford, Connecticut. Yarick is on the line. Hi, Yarick. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
I just wanted to comment on the public option question that it was posed earlier. You know, I do work for a health insurer, private health insurer, a large one, and you know, it's pretty clear as to why the public option was defeated, in my view. Public option would ultimately control prices, and if public option would control prices for healthcare services, ultimately a long-term effect would be diverting of consumers and members to the public option plan, because ultimately, you know, the private health insurers would not be able to compete. So obviously, the private health insurers were successful in lobbying against that, because we don't have that public option in place.
I'm curious, what do you think about this new program, this federal government proposal to rein in insurance premiums?
Well, I am somewhat biased. I got to say, I did grow up in Europe, so you know, obviously, I do support it. There's really two ways, in my view, to control prices. You know, because ultimately medical cost inflation is that what everybody cares about, and the two ways to control prices is either through control prices, or you introduce more competition into the system. And I don't think you can introduce easily more competition into the system. You know, build more hospitals. Let's just say in one urban area.
I hear it, Yarick. Thank you very much for your call. Let's get to another one. Here's Hannah in Nashville, Tennessee. Hannah, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to say that unless they outline a strong physician reimbursement structure, they cannot have a successful healthcare reform. Physicians are the backbone of the healthcare in America. Right now, physicians are dropping Medicare and Medicaid patients because of very, very low reimbursements. And as there, you already know that there's a primary care shortage, a nurse shortage, physician assistant shortage, and also there's a specialty care shortage. People have to travel 60 to 70 miles to get OBGYN care. Most of the OBGYN physicians are dropping out of the practice because they cannot afford their malpractice insurance. So unless there's a strong physician reimbursement outlined in the healthcare reform, I don't know that a majority of the physician community would support it.
You don't see it being successful. Hannah, thank you very much for the call. In our last couple of minutes here, I want to turn to our roundtable and ask what you each think is the biggest issue that still needs to be addressed on healthcare today, things that were not addressed in last month's bill that may not even be in this proposal that Senator Feinstein has made this week to rein in these skyrocketing insurance premiums. Quickly, each of you, Carmen Balver, we'll begin with you.
Well, I'm going to stick to the topic that we're discussing here. We have advocated since the beginning of this health reform debate and since 1988 when Consumer Watchdog's founder passed strong rate regulation for property casualty insurance in California that someone has to be strictly regulating the premiums health insurers charge. And so we would say that this proposal to encourage state rate regulation and have a federal backstop if states fail to act is the number one loophole that remains in the health reform bill.
Gail Walensky, 30 seconds. What's your big issue?
Reforming how we reimburse physicians. This was not a part of health care reform, inexplicably. And, oh, yes, by the way, don't forget about tort reform.
Hmm. Noam Levy, you get the final word here in our last minute.
Well, I think we touched on it earlier, but the price of the underlying cost of medical care in this country, how much hospitals are charging, doctors are charging, that is an incredibly complicated issue. It's very politically sensitive. It may require more, not less, regulation, but right now it's out of control.
Noam Levy, health policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times, joining us today from Chicago. Noam, thank you very much, as always. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Carmen Balber, director for the Washington, D.C. Office of Consumer Watchdog, a nonprofit that advocates for consumer and taxpayer interests. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. Carmen, thanks to you.
Thanks. Good to be on.
And Gail Walensky joining me from Bethesda, Maryland. She's economist and senior fellow at Project HOPE, an international health education foundation. She ran the Medicare and Medicaid programs under President George H.W. Bush from 1990 to 1992. Gail, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.